Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy of the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of The Spiritual Life by St. Theophane the Recluse. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Hey, welcome back to our study of St. Theophane's correspondence to the young Anastasia. And we're picking up with a new letter here this evening, letter 68 on page 267, if you're following along. It's entitled The Need of a Good Counselor. And it's something of a misnomer, I think, an odd title, although he does speak about this within the text, but a lot of it has to do with speech. And avoiding, in particular, sinful speech and allowing the conscience, in particular, to guide and direct us. And so a large portion of the text really has to do with that. And then towards the end of the letter, he speaks more specifically about the importance of having a good counselor, someone to guide you in the spiritual life. So a lot of what we'll be looking at here is things that have to do with rumor, gossip, and things such as that. Okay, so again, we're on page 267. May the grace of God be with you. Your words, a rumor went around, had quite an effect on my heart. Well, how terrible and biting is the fire of speech and the suspicious eye of man. It is clear why the holy prophet David in the Psalms often appeals to God with heartfelt sorrow to deliver him from the human tongue. And so she at least repeats something that had been going around as a rumor amongst her and her friends. And this strikes Theophane to the heart because he knows the danger of this, how seductive it can be to perpetuate such things. Discussion about others, either detraction or calumny, and that it can really lead us into great sin over the course of time. And he makes reference to King David here, lamenting the fact that the human tongue is often something that leads a person into great sorrow. Most often we've had many experiences where we regret having said things, you know, in anger or whatever it might be that drives us to it. And often the elders say, you know, I've never regretted times that I've been silent, but I regret many times that I've spoken. And I think that's probably true for most of us. Things, times that we've let words slip out that were either weren't well thought through or that were driven more by our emotion and not considering the other person, either the effect that it has upon the one we're speaking to or upon the reputation that we of the person that we might be speaking about. And so he speaks of it almost as being a wound to him, as if and somehow she neglected some earlier teaching, and that she would repeat a rumor worries him for the future. And so he spends a great deal of time here speaking to her about how conscience is to be sharpened, in particular to guard her against such speech. He goes on to say, where are you to find comfort and support in the testimony of your conscience? Keep this consciousness of the moral worth of your actions before God and all sober-minded people in your mind and heart. With this, you will courageously encounter every kind of speech, no matter what is said. At the same time, you should treat everyone as if you know nothing. So, your conscience is not only what guides her, in regards to what is right and wrong in terms of one's speech. But it also is to guide her in how she responds to the speech of others. So not only what she should avoid saying about other people or to them, but the kind of speech and discussion that she should participate in, that conscience will give her the courage to step away when necessary. And this is something I think we often have difficulty with, that at times conversations begin and they then take a turn to talking about someone, and sometimes talking about them in a disparaging way. And often we rationalize and, you know, describe it as a kind of rationalization that we're just venting, and, you know, venting with our closest friends, you know, to alleviate, you know, our hearts. And the next thing you know, there's a full-blown conversation that is going on with everybody adding to it, and the process perhaps tearing down another person's reputation, criticizing them for this or that. And this can snowball, certainly, over the course of time. Whole groups of individuals can sort of get caught up in this practice, and at times even as a form of entertainment. You know, the idea of talking around the water cooler, as it is, the kind of gossip that goes on, can be a very dangerous kind of thing, because it's seen as innocent and seen as something that's harmless. Again, a kind of form of entertainment. And it's for this reason, I think, that he speaks so sharply with her here, that it can be deeply wounding, and not only to the individual, but to one's own heart. And the last line is striking. He says, at the same time, you should treat everyone as if you know nothing. And in reality, this is true. It's not only good advice, that we would treat everyone as if we really know nothing about their motivation for doing certain things, that we do not know what is going on in their heart, that we know nothing about their particular experiences. And that way we won't be tempted to speak about them or what they're doing, and or to make any judgment, in fact, whatsoever about them. And this is something that, where I think we can all see here where a kind of great asceticism would be needed. The first, just keeping our mouth shut, I think is the big one, that even though these things might be going through our mind, we would become more and more practiced in remaining silent, and over time allowing, again, our conscience to give us the courage that we need to remove ourselves from conversations where this kind of thing is going on. And so we begin to look at others with the most charitable eye possible, evaluating from a position of generosity, you know, acting in accord with hermeneutic, as it were, of generosity, that we always would interpret in the most positive light, even if we see something going on in another person's life, we hear them say something or engage in a certain action, we still have to admit that we don't know what's going on in their heart, what is giving rise to these actions or to these words of theirs. And so we act as if completely ignorant of what that is. And so we have to maintain the position of silence. We don't know if the person is speaking, where they're speaking from, if there's wounds there, or what it is that's driving them. And at least we should be able to say to ourselves that it would be a demon tempting a person into a particular action, so as that we don't take lose sight of the dignity of the human person. We realize that a person may be afflicted by the habit of sin, or being afflicted by particular demons, being tempted. And so we always seek to give the most positive interpretation. Okay. And, you know, that's a humbling path to take, because we often think that we're in the right judgment. We have the right judgment, that we're seeing things with a kind of clarity. And here Theophan is basically telling us, we see nothing. We see nothing about the reality of the other person's heart. And it doesn't mean that we don't experience, I think, the pain of other people's words or actions, or that there are times where there's injustice. You know, I think we have to acknowledge that, but we still cannot be quick to make the judgment about the person directly. Any comments or questions? Anyone want to follow up? Okay, a couple of hands went up right away. It was Lau and Andrea and Anthony at the same time. So who would like to go first?
Andrea and Anthony, have at it.
Okay.
Thank you, Lyle. So I agree with the emphasis here. I was also just wondering about one thing you said, Father, about some Holy Father saying that, you know, I've never regretted not saying something. And mm-hmm. I was thinking I have. I have regretted sometimes being silent when perhaps I should have said something. Mm-hmm. And I feel that we see that in our society a lot. You know, just to give a very coarse example, a couple of weeks ago, there was some news that a woman was assaulted in plain daylight in the New York train. Mm-hmm. Nobody said anything. Mm-hmm. There were many people around, nobody said anything. And just on other more day-to-day examples, you know, I see many times in front of us people speaking badly about our faith, or, you know, speaking unkindly to somebody that's under our care or even to ourselves. And, you know, sometimes people just don't say anything. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's right. You know, I think that there's a proper thing where, you know, we have to say something, even if it's unpleasant or the other person doesn't like to hear it.
Right. Well, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I would agree fully with it, that there are certain acts of injustice that would demand then and love that we would say something or do something. And I think the bigger problem in the subway was that nobody did anything to help her or even to call the police. So egregious lack of charity there. And so I understand what you're saying. And there would be, I think, other times as well where there is injustice, where we might be seeking to protect the other. But I think what St. Theophan is speaking of here, and even the elder that I mentioned, is that in our day-to-day life, and in terms of what goes on in our own minds and hearts and in our own speech, that the prevalent behavior is to give voice nearly to every thought that we have and to make quick judgments of the other person. That we have a proclivity, I think, to making judgments about other people's behavior. And we often will justify that in terms of a kind of moral judgment as well. And I think what a lot of the saints tell us is that even when we do see something that seems to be clearly sinful in our own eyes, that we have to be ever so cautious in this regard about the judgment that we make. Because again, we don't know what is acting upon the person or what is going on within their hearts. And so, you know, while I would believe that any of these spiritual writers would say, yes, you're right, Anthony, you know, that in the face of injustice and the affliction of the other, that love, the charity would demand that one would say something and act. And even St. Catherine at one point of Siena, you know, sort of cries out, enough of the silence. You know, when there was so much going on, I think in her day and within the church where there was open corruption. But, you know, we have to acknowledge too that it was St. Catherine, you know, one who had lived this extraordinarily life of, you know, deep spirituality, deep prayer, asceticism, who had purified her heart and loved the church. And one of the great books that I read in recent times is by Raniero Cantalamessa. He was a preacher to the papal household. And he wrote a little book called Loving the Church. And there's a little section in there where he talks about Only when one has really suffered for the church, then can one dare speak a word in judgment of her. When one has, you know, done penance for her, shed blood for her, prayed for her in every way, that then can one take upon oneself the role of offering a correction. And at one point he tells a little story of, you know, what would one do if someone's, you know, insulted one's wife, you know, publicly, that would he not, would that person not bring down the ire of her husband, you know, in doing so? And in a similar way, I think we are, you know, to love the church and to love others in this kind of way, and not being so willing to speak against her or others without having prayed for them, made sacrifices on their behalf, fasted for them, you know, have done everything or engaged them directly and privately, as the scriptures tell us, you know, to go to them privately to offer that correction. Nowhere in the scripture do I hear say, you know, spread rumor about them or criticize publicly, that the sort of the movement there is from this individual engagement that is rooted in love and a genuine concern for the welfare and the spiritual well-being of the other. And only when that is something that is rejected, then is another brought, and then so on down the line. And so even when there is matter of grave sin, or apparently so, that ours should be one of caution, you know, personally, that we would, you know, be aware of the weakness of the human heart. And again, our capacity for misjudgment, that we're not omniscient. And so the greatest care and prayer is to go in to this. I mean, there is a kind of morbid delight, I think, that we also see in our day in exposing the flaws of others. So again, you know, getting back to your point, you know, when there's a matter of justice, or certainly when we're protecting someone, love would demand that someone would stand up and speak or act. But I think in our day-to-day spiritual life, we have to guard our hearts in order to make sure that we are acting out of charity, that love is guiding even those rebukes that might have to be made. And I think I've mentioned this in previous groups, that in the early oratory, an office was held within the community called the Office of the Corrector. And it was the member of the community who had the responsibility of engaging the members of the community about whether or not they were following the role. And so if somebody repeatedly was not living in the way that they were supposed to, that this individual was to take them aside and engage them about it. And Phillips set it down that only, you know, an older member, wiser, one who is obedient himself in living out the role, was to be given this position. And it's funny, when you read the stories about this, that inevitably they show up at the room of the one they corrected, their cassocks covered in dust because they had prostrated themselves in their room because they feared that they had spoken too harshly and may have broken down charity with a fellow brother in the community. No matter how gently they had spoken, that they had worried that they had in this correction perhaps wounded that relationship in some way. And I've always found that striking, because it's saying that even when there is a kind of clarity that we feel that we have, or when the specific charge has been given to us to correct another, that it is always charity that is to guide and direct and shape our words. Because even anger has to be tempered by love. And, you know, anger, the emotion of anger, often arises out of the experience of injustice or the witness of it. And it can flame up in a very strong way. But It is to be tempered by love. And this is what meekness is. And meekness is not weakness. It's not being weak before others or being a doormat. It is this capacity to allow that anger to be shaped and guided by love. And that so we are acting purely out of love for the other, even when or that insensitive faculty that we've so often spoken of becomes active and leads us to offer that correction. So, you know, having said all that, really the mind and the heart have to be purified on this very deep level. And, you know, here for a young woman who is talking to him about rumors that she heard about, he becomes very worried about this, that in some sense, her conscience is not guiding her in a strong enough fashion to make her avoid these circumstances or to remove herself from them. And so I think what Theophan has more in mind is what takes place on this daily basis in terms of rumor, gossip, and other sins of speech, tale bearing, all those kinds of things. So you're right. You know, there is a time for speaking, but I think what he's engaging her here about are the particular sins of speech that we fall into daily. Okay. Lyle.
Yes, Father. It's just so wonderful that these sayings of the ancients apply to so many parts of our life, not just the spiritual. But for example, when I read that verse again, it reminded me of one of my weaknesses, which was to anticipate too many times what somebody's going to say in a conversation. and coming from a financial background and working with so many clients, I had heard every comment practically that could be heard with respect to, you know, specific elementary questions. Mm-hmm. And I had a very bad habit of cutting them off and saying, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. And I love that about spiritual directors when they give the person an opportunity, you know, to completely say what they need to say, even if there are 5,000 you knows, you know, interspersed within whatever they have to say. But it really spoke to my heart. So hopefully the next 70 some years of my life, I'll be a little more polite.
That's an excellent point. And finishing people's sentences, you know, it's, again, we're assuming there's a kind of pride there because we're assuming that we know what they're going to say. And I think it can be especially true where we will cut off people when what they're saying is uncomfortable for us, as you sort of intimated, or when anger is perhaps being directed towards us, you know, for something that we did, either real or perceived, and we can get become very defensive rather than hearing a person out. And in that, there can be a lack of charity too, cutting another individual off, as you said. It takes, you know, a great deal of love for another to let them, as you said, have their say and to speak their mind. Why don't we go a little bit further here and we'll see what else he has to say about it. And we'll come back. If you still have some thoughts about things that we had talked about, you know, feel free to bring them up. He goes on to say, it is impossible in everyday life to completely ignore what people are saying or what they will say. In general, the prudent thing here should be to go only to the extent that you conduct your affairs in such a way as to not provoke the speech and offend the eyes of men. You do not have to go any further, say to the extent where you give up doing things that are considered necessary. So, you know, he's telling her that as a Christian woman, as a woman of faith, that, you know, she is to conduct her affairs in a way that is distinctively Christian and engage in speech in a way that is distinctively Christian as well. that always guarding the heart, precisely not to be provocative, not trying to stir up the emotions of the other or to bring them to anger. And we can do that. There can be a kind of pleasure in doing such things, that we will be inflammatory in our speech or mocking and trying to sort of emotionally, subtly, there can be an attempt to emotionally manipulate people or to gain the position of emotional power in that. You know, we begin to play with others in the way that we are talking to them, play with them on an emotional level. And not that this is necessarily what he's engaging her about here, but I think he's telling her, you know, when you go out and you engage others, you want to be careful that you're speaking to them respectfully, being attentive to their feelings, not to be insulting in any way so as not to provoke them, and not to offend the eyes of men. So our demeanor, I think he's trying to tell her as a whole too. One doesn't have to be doing anything, seductive, but I think one's posture towards another can color the nature of these encounters. You know, if we can take aggressive postures towards others, or the expression on our face can be provocative. So even without speech, we might offend the eyes of others or mislead them. My resting face is sort of like an angry bear. And sometimes I have to be careful about that, because, you know, it can leave people wondering, you know, or, you know, did you not like what I was saying, or were you angry, or make them afraid of you, you know, rather than have you be someone who's approachable or that is seen to be understanding. And he tells her, you don't have to go any further than this. Certainly you don't have to give up doing what is necessary in day-to-day life. And again, this is probably something that goes contrary to natural sensibilities, because we have a tendency towards this curiosity. We want to be out and about and engaged in entertaining ourselves in one form or another. It's very hard for us to stay at home, as it were, within our heart or in our surroundings. And so it's seen as something that's enriching to be out and about and involved in other people's affairs. So sometimes people can be like a gadfly. Is that the right word? Where they sort of hop around from one person to another, or one conversation to another. And I think this is along the lines of what he's trying to help her avoid. You know, don't go out seeking these kinds of circumstances where you're going to be drawn into conversations that give rise to rumors. And, we have found newer and better ways to do that. Now we have access to millions of people where we could do that with them. You know, we could be as provocative as we want, insulting as we want, because we know that we're not going to be punched in the face or chased down for the things that we say. It's easy to, you know, be bold with a person who lives 1,000 miles away and who we think that we're never going to encounter again. And so I think what he's saying here is important for us to hear and to take it as a whole. You know, I think if we stop at the first paragraph or two that I read, it can make it sound like, all right, we're to be mute and not to say anything. And I think from our conversation here, we see, well, that's not true. But in terms of living the spiritual life, maintaining charity, respecting other human beings, we should be much more introspective in terms of what we are thinking before we verbalize it. Christ says, out of the heart, the mouth speaks. And, you know, it speaks all kinds of evils. And so our focus should be first on the purification of the heart. And so I think our natural tendency should be more toward silence, knowing our need to guard the heart than it should be to constant chatter and witter.
Yeah, I don't know if this really has any value, but what's sort of been on my mind when it comes to what we've been reading tonight is that, like, none of the feelings that we have, like, none of the situations in which we might be led to think ill of or speak ill of or feel ill towards another person are things that are situations that are exclusive to people we don't like. Like, everyone's gotten mad at someone they love, you know? Everyone's been frustrated by someone they love. And I think maybe just thinking back on that experience is a really great way of gauging just how far from loving our experience of being angry or frustrated with someone we don't like is. Because when I'm, like, angry with someone I really care about, it's actually, like, a very painful thing. Like, you don't want to be angry at all, and you don't want that situation to exist. And so there's this desire to just, like, resolve it and move on. And the same thing with, like, I think about how differently I react when I hear something not quite right, whether it's, like, cruel or just, like, not well-informed said about someone I really care about, versus someone I'm eager to share a gossipy conversation about. And it's just, like, on the one hand, I just want to shut it down. Like, oh, well, guys, like, that's really, you know, this is actually what's going on. Or you just want to totally move it away because you love that person and care about them. Versus the other, where it's like, oh, I have a story about them too. And it's just so interesting that, like, we can be in the same position, but our behavior is so vastly different, depending on about, you know, how we feel. And, you know, certainly, you know, the thought of, like, well, what if someone's actually hurt me? How do I behave? And it's like, well, behave in the way that you would towards someone who hurt you, but who you love and care about. Because we all know what that is. It's just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think, you know, we are, again, you're right, willing to take, you know, even greater liberties. I think when there is a kind of distance there, you know, to even spend less time in reflecting upon what's going on internally. You know, we often don't characterize sins of speech as being as serious as they are, or having the need for healing, that we often will see them as small things, you know, whether it's telling a white lie or something like engaging in some gossip or passing along a rumor. But there, you know, it's not only, you know, for us, truth is a person. And so in some sense, you know, to speak an untruth is to sin against he who is truth, but it's also sin against charity. It's a sin against love, that we are breaking down the dignity of the other person. And so at times these sins of speech can be very grave or lead to something that is very grave. Okay, let's move on to the next paragraph. You have expressed any sort of peculiarity. Wait, I'm sorry. This is an odd sentence here. Well, have you expressed any sort of peculiarity up to this point? Possibly the fact that you went to St. Sergius, but this was not done publicly and you were among your own kind, or that you go to church for vigil and liturgy on Sundays and feast days. But this is a duty that is faithfully carried out by all Christians who keep in mind that they are Christians. One may be excused from this only by extreme necessity without earning reproach for laziness and neglect of one's Christianity. Do not imitate bad habits of the upper-class ladies of Moscow or listen to their vain words. That is today, tomorrow is death. Death has no regard for beautiful women, it cuts them down as well. After death, there will be an immediate accounting. The clever-mindedness of upper-class ladies will by no means be taken into consideration there. So, sort of harsh little statement there, but I think this, you know, what often comes, and he'll address this in a later letter, but, you know, with certain gifts that come to a person naturally or come by the circumstances of their state. So beauty, wealth, clever-mindedness, you know, that these things that one has, one can sort of take a kind of pride within them and use them in such a way as, again, to elevate oneself in the eyes of others. There can be a kind of vanity in doing so. And so he doesn't want her to become enamored with this. She's moved to Moscow and she's moved to the city, and it would be very easy for her, I think, to be attracted to this, to see the admiration that certain individuals have in the eyes of others and the privilege that they have, and to desire that for herself, or worse, he tells her to imitate them in this kind of behavior. And so he reminds her that, you know, death is going to come to them as sure as it comes to anybody else. And so what is beautiful today will be ash tomorrow. And she must not forget that. And you know, again, I think in our own day, there is this kind of temptation to imitate celebrity, you know, that we are as enamored as she might have been with the rich and the famous in Moscow. And it's often the celebrities that guide, you know, the culture, you know, regardless of who they are or their background or their goodness. That the, because they are well known, they can often be imitated, especially by the youth, and because of the kind of natural attractiveness that they have or the abilities that they have. And so I think if he were speaking in our day, he would probably address that as well, you know, that this means nothing in the end. They're all going to end in the same place that we are, regardless of the salary they make or the fame they have. And what you are to be, what you are to care about the most is what is most precious and has the most valuable of value. And that is the human heart. The only thing that we take out of the world is virtue or vice. And that is what she is to be aware of. Do not be troubled by words then. You do everything for your part so as not to provoke them. If in spite of everything they happen, then let them. The witness of conscience before God is sufficient, as I said, for comforting and strengthening of your courage. Let everyone judge you, but if God justifies you in the conscience, these judgments will amount to nothing. An observant person was telling me that as soon as men's words latch onto something that is truly unpleasant, they hang over a person like a cloud that does not give any rain and then depart. Their traces grow cold and no one remembers what was said anymore. It will be the same with you, I think. I wish this for you from the bottom of my heart. Conduct yourself equably, as usual, as if you do not notice anything. So even if she becomes the focal point of other people's rumors or gossip, if people begin to talk about her because of her piety or to disparage her because of it, she is to give it no account that in a sense she's to ignore it and to allow her conscience again to give her a particular kind of courage not to respond in kind. That eventually what is spoken will disappear, as he says, like this cloud that might hang over her for a period of time, but then, you know, drops no rain and then disappears. That for a while, the things that people say might, you know, surround her with a kind of gloom or paint a negative picture of her in the eyes of others, but the courage of her faith and the courage of a conscience that is clear in terms of how she's living her life should make her, in a sense, impervious to these things, as if she, you know, almost did not hear them. And what she is supposed to do is to act equably towards everyone, you know, regardless of how they treat her or the things that have been said, that she would not simply use what they've said, if it, say, it was biting in some way, as an excuse then to let loose on them or to get even or to give back, you know, even in greater kind. Which can be our tendency too. Somebody insults us and then we give it back to them double barrel, you know, to let them not only know that we felt the sting of their words, but to give them back a little something extra in the process so as to discourage them from doing it in the future. And this is where kind of cleverness comes in. You know, if we come back with this sharp and biting, sarcastic statement, you know, that's going to teach them a lesson not to mess with me. If you mess with the bull, you get the horns, kind of thing. And that's the message that we want to send to others. And he's telling her, don't take the bait. And this is an important thing, because I think in our relations with others, you know, a whole host of things can go on, gaslighting, but also this kind of baiting that takes place. Somebody will put forward something, you know, that they know is likely to provoke you, and they want to provoke this emotion out of you because they think it puts you in a vulnerable position. It gives them a sense of control over you. And I think once we learn not to take that bait, you know, sometimes people can say something to us that is clearly off the mark, offer a criticism with a little something added, a little mustard on top that, you know, and so it becomes biting. And we will take the bait and we'll respond to that in a defensive posture and become angry. And then you can see on the face a kind of glee that this response was provoked. You know, they got you, because now you're unsettled. You're off kilter emotionally. And that allows the person to then drive the conversation where they want it to go. And so maintaining this internal stability, and he says, you know, engage everybody equably, you know, so, you know, whenever they're engaging us in a certain way, don't respond immediately. Don't take that bait, but try to treat everyone respecting their dignity. Andrea and Anthony.
Yeah, thank you, Father. So I think maybe the last sentence that you said, you know, clarified things in my head a little more. But I, again, you know, struggle sometimes with when is proper to be silent and when we have to speak and say something, right? You know, so we can't all be silent. For example, in my position, I find myself in situations where people do say things bitingly or whatever because they have an agenda. And I cannot just be silent because I also need to move the conversation in a different direction. So I have to set things straight. Always being silent, it doesn't really help me as much. I sometimes I'm in the position where something needs to be said. Just how to say it, maybe that's the disposition of heart that we're talking about.
Right. Well, I think some of what we said earlier applies here as well. But say if you are at work and you're managing a team of people and someone does this, baits, or, you know, presents a scenario that is off in such a way that it derails the conversation from being productive, that you know, our response to that has to be guided by a kind of internal steadiness and peace, even while we pull it back to where it needs to be. I was watching an interview the other day of, there's a physician who, I think he was running for president at one time. I can't remember his name. Does anybody remember who I'm talking about? Goodness sake. You would know it as soon as you heard it.
Ron Paul?
No. His glasses, a black gentleman.
Is it Ben Carson?
Ben Carson, thank you. And he was being interviewed, and the interviewer was setting things up as if he had been saying something that he wasn't, that he was attacking something in what he had said and in this comparison that he'd made. And it was interesting that he maintained this kind of steady state. And he said, you know, the words that we use are important. And he said, this is what I actually said. And then he goes on to clarify it. And even to sort of, even directly sort of pointing out how the interview was going, you know, what was, how that sort of radically changes the meaning and puts him in this position of attacking something when this is not what he was doing at all. And so it was surprising, you know, that he was able to do this, you know, whether one agrees with his politics or whatever, doesn't matter. It's how he was able to do this was not to sort of take the bait of that, which often interviews sort of go down that line. You know, there's almost an adversarial relationship that begins to develop rather than it being an interview to get another person's thoughts on something or even to ask direct questions. The questions can be put in a way that puts the person on the defensive. And he was able, getting back to Anthony's thought here, he was able in that moment to engage what was being said, but not simply to act out of that defensiveness or out of the anger. He was able to offer the correction, but to do so peacefully and then move on to what else he was saying, even while I think the individual continued to bait and push him on it. He was able to maintain his presence of mind and focus. And I thought this is a wonderful example of choosing one's words carefully, but also listening to another person and how they're using words and how they might even be misunderstanding what is being said, and that you can bring a conversation back to where it needs to be, even where you feel that there is this kind of direct animosity that is trying to derail what you're doing or trying to derail a meeting or discussion. And so again, I think this takes a kind of purity of heart that he's trying to lead Anastasia towards, as well as a conscience that is strong, that is able not to take that bait, not to respond in kind, even when one feels one is being attacked, and trying to listen and understand even the person that is engaging us and why they might be engaging us in the way that they are. And what we say back to them might be corrective, as you're saying, but still not be driven, you know, to simply give back in kind or worse. And again, this is what would be distinctively unique, I think, about the way that Christians would approach. There's a Christian ethic involved here, how we would respond to these kinds of situations and what guides and directs us. And he's telling her very specifically, it's that voice of the omnipresent God within us and speaking to us through the conscience. And this should give us a kind of courage to be able to engage others, even to hear what they say. And even if they are attacking our character, our conscience should give us such courage, even though we feel that they're putting that dark cloud over our head, that we can then engage them with peace of mind and heart. And if we correct them, again, we do it you know, with this kind of clarity. So, you know, that sort of takes us back to the idea of meekness not being weakness, that it's actually a strength, an incredible strength. It's a virtue, and that comes from this confidence that conscience gives, but also that love instills within the human heart, that even when we are engaging somebody that we feel is trying to trip us up or trying to make us angry or trying to derail what we're doing, that we're able to, in that, with that presence of mind, to engage them out of love. And, you know, admittedly, there are all kinds of scenarios, I think, where, you know, a person aggresses against us, where we might have to end that discussion, you know, in the sense of putting up a boundary of saying either this is toxic or it's getting violent, or that we're on two parallel lines, never really to intersect, and that furthering the conversation is only going to endanger, you know, the flaming up of tempers. And so we might have to cease certain conversations for the sake of charity. We might have to avoid them. If you think about it, if you have a follow-up to that, I'll take Sawyer's thought here. And if you want to follow up with something, Sawyer.
So I was thinking about, I guess, at these instances where these things come up, it almost feels like exercising a muscle, that this kind of that immediate, I mean, and I think oftentimes there's a the ego and the sense of the I, the attachment to self, that flares in these instances, and that subduing that, the practice of doing that, even in small things, can kind of strengthen that detachment from that, and that kind of clinging to ourselves and our views. And that I think as that detachment occurs, I think oftentimes in these kind of heated or frustrating interactions, kind of becoming aware of, as a parent, when I'm parenting my children, especially younger children, and they're having these kind of temper tantrums or trying to push my buttons or these different things, that we all do that, I mean, throughout life. And that, I mean, when I'm interacting with an adult, I'm thinking of them as having this kind of control in this different sort of way. But kind of when I can step back a little bit, it's there's very much that young kind of a need. I mean, there's kind of like everybody has these needs that they're wanting to get met. And that there's this, I mean, I think that it helps to be able to see them more charitably. I think step back and kind of detach a little bit from self.
Right. Excellent. And, you know, I have a couple thoughts that came to mind in response to what you're saying is that you're right. The ego can really jump in there and immediately, I think, makes us want to respond to that. And I think for the Christian, you know, it is to put on the mind of Christ, you know, that is no longer I who live, I, ego, it is Christ who lives within me. And so we put on the mind of Christ and we begin to act out of that relationship in terms of how we engage others and the way that we view them. Everything becomes shaped now by this greater reality in which we live. And, you know, I think we often find ourselves doing this and we can see others doing it in terms of anticipating what we are going to say to the other. And I think this is getting back to what Lyle said earlier, that when we do that, we stop listening and we're anticipating what we're going to say in response. And so we might not really be engaging what they said at all, and not giving their words real weight and worth in the process. Because what we are most interested in is the thought going through our mind and what we want to say. And, you know, having studied psychoanalysis, not that it's the end all be all, but one thing I think I did learn from it is that the suspension of judgment and this sustained listening that takes place. You know, most people, it's often characterized in movies, you know, as the analyst sitting there and saying nothing or drawing, doodling, you know, or, you know, this person is writing on his notepad, this person is crazy kind of thing, you know. And what it really is, though, is, and this is a sort of an interesting little detail, Freud never took notes during a session. He always would stay up late at night writing down notes about a session that he had with a person, because he wanted in that moment to give full attention to what was being said or not said or how the person was acting. And there's a wisdom in this, because in that he could listen on this very deep level to what a person is saying and not making any prior judgments about the meaning, the value of it, you know, or the morality of it even, you know. And I think sometimes this can be a danger for us as religious men and women, because, you know, things do have a moral weight to them. I'm not trying to say that, but sometimes we have to suspend judgment in such a way in order to be able to listen to the other, to listen to the other person, to enter into what they are saying or what they are experiencing, and wonder, never lose that capacity to wonder about the other, the mystery of the other person, what they've been through, what they're going through, what their experience of things is. And as Christians, we should be the most adept at doing this because of love, that we would listen with charity that allows us to suspend that judgment and always see the other before us, that we value them so much that we aren't going to make an immediate judgment about what they're saying or how they're treating us, but be able to listen. This, again, this doesn't mean that we say nothing or that we never offer a response to that. But again, that the other takes priority there, the person takes priority in love, that over and above what we hear and see. And that's a hard thing for us to do, to suspend that judgment and allow ourselves to simply engage them as they are and try to understand that. We don't even understand what we're thinking half the time. How are we going to understand what the heck another person is thinking and what's going through their mind or what they're experiencing? I've had two contradicting thoughts in my mind so many different times that it's confusing. You know, you're walking around with, angry and, you know, having the opposite feeling at the same time, or the opposite thought about something, judgment about something at the same time. And it's important for our own sake and our own sanity to be able to do that, to hold these contradictory thoughts and ideas in our minds at the same time, you know, about ourselves and others, in order that we might really discern, you know, the truth of a situation and be able to act again in accord with our conscience, and to be able to listen not only to the other, but especially to listen to God on the deepest of levels. I think most of us have had that experience where we think, you know, what the heck are you doing, God? You know, we'll be angry at him. You know, he's not helping me out here at all. In fact, just the opposite. He's making my life miserable, you know, and we don't have this ability to suspend that judgment and to listen to God, or to think about what is taking place in our own life in light of the cross, in light of all that God has given us. We can make God out to be, you know, this angry kid who's ripping off the wings of flies or something like that. But, you know, he takes pleasure in, you know, our suffering. And, you know, part of that is because we are suffering. And, you know, as a priest, you have to sort of understand that people are often going through hell. And what they need at that moment is not somebody who's going to quote the catechism to them. They need somebody who's going to listen to them and listen to them in such a way that it's not simply a natural virtue of compassion or gentleness, but the person can experience the love, the understanding, and the mercy of Christ. Especially in the confessional. It never makes sense to me whenever you hear about a priest who is mean, you know, within the confessional, where that sense of the mercy of God disappeared. Joyce and Jim Walsh.
This is Joyce.
Hello.
Hi. I was just going to say something I've been trying to personally work on is meeting people where they are. Mm-hmm. Jesus met people where they are. He didn't like launch into things immediately. And I think the example that I was reading about was the woman at the well. Like he didn't launch. He kind of talked to her. And then at the end, he said what he had to say. And then I think sometimes speaking for myself is I'm too impatient to say what I want to say. And sometimes we have to wait until that person is ready to hear what we have to say. Because like if they're angry or upset, I mean, maybe it's a week later, a month later, or, you know, like whatever. So I've been just trying to work on that. And I thought that was kind of related to what we were talking about.
Yeah, excellent. You know, that story at the well, you know, he asked her to give him a drink of water. And, you know, Jews wouldn't have talked to Samaritans. And, you know, Jesus hanging out at a well with a woman at that time, too, would have been problematic, you know, and alone because the disciples had gone off. And then, you know, asking her, you know, give me a drink of water kind of thing. He opens up, in fact, the possibility for discussion there with her. And to the point then that she, you know, he's able to engage her in such a way that it was so non-threatening that she like pours out her life's story. You know, she's able to acknowledge, you know, and he's able to see, you know, certainly everything about her and communicate that in a way that she runs back to town telling everyone she's encountered the Messiah, who's told her everything, you know, everything she's ever done. And she doesn't find that shaming, but freeing, that he's able to do it in a way that expresses the mercy of God, and so powerfully that she's lifted up, not driven down into the dust. So very, very powerful example there. So, you know, it's a challenging thing, you know, as you said, not to anticipate, I think, with the others doing and saying. And the final thought that came to mind was Newman. And I talked to somebody about this earlier today, I think, or yesterday. But, you know, Newman was a great intellect, convert to the faith, you know, wrote publicly about the faith and engaged in, you know, all kinds of discussions about it. And yet said that, you know, it is as ridiculous to try to argue someone into the faith as it is to torture them into the faith, which is a telling thing. You know, Newman was this extraordinary mind. He had the capacity to engage anybody wherever they were, you know, about life and about faith, you know, that of the 19th century, he was one of the greatest thinkers. And yet he understood that faith is a gift, and the gift that comes from God. And so that one can take opportune moments, one can articulate the faith to the best of one's abilities, but to club someone over the head with that faith is foolhardy. And something tells me that he learned that from Philip Neri. You know, that Philip Neri was this gentle soul who fished with a line rather than the net. And if you remember, Philip Neri grew up in Florence, and it was there that he encountered Savonarola, who was this fiery Dominican preacher who was eventually burned at the stake. But, you know, that, and he admired the zeal of Savonarola. You know, the church was in the state of great corruption, and, you know, he preached with this kind of fierceness. But Philip learned something, you know, about that. He did not, he even had a picture of Savonarola hanging in his room, which was sort of an unusual thing to have hanging in his room. But he did not imitate him in his evangelization, that Philip was this gentle soul who engaged individuals on the street and in a very personal kind of fashion, you know, with his gentleness, joyfulness, where he sought to engage them where they were. And so very much like Jesus with the woman at the well, Philip encountered all kinds of individuals in Rome at the time. And some of them he brought to this incredible conversion of life, simply because he made himself accessible, but also that there was this joyful kind of demeanor that wasn't just, again, natural temperament, but was something of the expression of the joy of the kingdom. But he knew Christ in his heart so deeply that he had this confidence then to engage people where they were, but with a kind of gentleness of spirit, meekness. Brian Witter.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you were talking about Newman and gentleness, and I was thinking, the other day I saw a picture posted by the Birmingham Oratory of Philip's personal altar, the one he erected after he was made a cardinal, and it's where he said Mass every day. And I was really struck by the fact that the saint that he chose to have a painting of over his altar was the other holy oratorian who's probably like the only one who could rival Philip in gentleness, which was Francis de Sales. And and I just thought it was very striking that that's who, if no one knew that, Francis de Sales is one of the oratorian guys. So, you know, yeah. He was an oratorian. It is very striking that the saint who sort of nicknamed the saint of gentleness would be the one that Newman would pick to look at every day during Mass. So,
right. Yeah, I think it's tempting for us to go the other route in our speech, because it seems to promise, you know, a swifter response or reaction. You know, if we preach fiercely, or if we engage another with this sternness and this directness and aggressiveness, not just directness, but this kind of aggression, that it's going to bring about a response that we want from them at that moment. And without our, and we might not be thinking at all, is this the opportune moment? Or is this even a way that we should be speaking at this person, to this person at this moment? And our final comment for the night, Andrea or Anthony?
Father David, you had mentioned before that, you know, a confessor has to be gentle and listen with the heart and mind of Christ. And I just wanted to relate some experiences that I have had during my lifetime confession when I joined the church in 2014. The priest at the end of the confession told me that, well, the gist being that, you know, I had made so many mistakes in my life, that it would be, I had committed such sin that it would be very difficult for me to grow in holiness. However, you're entering the church, I mean, just stay. So I was very discouraged by that. So the first several years, I would just sit in church, you know, thinking that, well, I'm just a sorry sinner. Everyone here is, I'm sure, much better than I am, but that's all right. At least I'm sitting in church. So, you know, maybe I can just slide into heaven, you know, God won't notice me, you know, just. So then sometime later, you know, as God was working with me on in deeper levels on of cleansing my conscience, my soul of things that I had allowed. So I encountered confessors who, or particularly one who, when I would confess, they, one, they did not seem shocked. You know, there was no like, oh, you did what? Really? You know, I mean, even if they are not that explicit, you can kind of tell if someone says, I cannot believe you did that, you know, in some way. But this person was very gentle. He would listen. He did not judge. The penance was not very hard. You know, it's no, it wasn't like run 100 times around the stadium or something, you know. So I knew that this person was regarding me with mercy, and that basically I encountered the kindness of Christ through him. And the effect that that had on my soul was not that I was not only that I was able to continue this deep kind of confessions as the Lord was bringing things up for me to be able to see. But it also, I had the courage to actually try to grow in virtue, because I did encounter the kindness of God. And I knew that he was not out to smite me, but rather that, you know, he wanted to cleanse my soul and enable me to grow further towards him. So to unburden me and to allow me to walk towards him, knowing that, you know, he desires my good, which is not really the punishment of my sin. He does not desire to punish me, you know, because of what I have done in the past, but rather he wants to remove the impurities so that I can walk with him in holiness. Anyway, to make a long story short, what I'm trying to say is that confessors have a great responsibility before God with the way that they are relating, interacting with, speaking, treating those who they encounter in confession, and that it is really a very grave duty to not discourage souls, you know, sort of like, you know, you talk about the office of the corrector within the community with the oratorians that used to exist. But it's kind of, you know, similar, you know, with a confessor, you know, that as you encounter people in their weakness, in their sin, you know, have to make sure that, you know, that the shame, that the person is not shamed, you know, whether by words or by gestures, but just gestures, small sounds made in the confessional, but rather that that person is allowed to encounter the mind and heart of Christ in confession, that that is really a grave duty for each priest who hears confessions, and that is part of their responsibility in the growth of that soul that God has entrusted to them in this particular confession.
Yeah, beautifully, beautifully put. But I would have you know, I stopped giving that penance years ago of 100 times around. just kidding. I never give that kind of penance. But a couple things you said that came to mind. Actually, a saint used that image of like the dust being drawn underneath the door as a way of sort of getting into heaven. It's sort of an interesting kind of thing, you know, that one would hope that one would be sort of drawn in by the force of the spirit, as it were, you know, like dust underneath the door, you know, drawn in, sucked in by heaven, that we would hope that God would show us that kind of mercy. But you're absolutely right. You know, I think, you know, in priests, not only within the confessional, but I think the pulpit as well. And, you know, our understanding of the word of God becoming flesh, that for us, you know, the word is, again, a person. Truth is a person. And how one articulates you know, the gospel and the message of the gospel from the pulpit, should the weight of that should be felt tangibly by the priest, and both in not only in what he says, but in how he prepares. And I think even again, you know, if we look at this sort of a training for the priesthood, it should be along the lines of what we're reading in Theophan and Evagrius and Climacus, in the sense of forming the heart, mind and the heart with humility, that, you know, out of the heart, that the words that we would speak would be the words of Christ, that have so formed and shaped the mind and the heart that they, you know, become identified with his own. And, you know, it's not meant, you know, the pulpit is not meant to be a stage, you know, for, you know, the personality of the priest or a particular agenda or, you know, but rather it's to be a reflection of, you know, what he has heard within the depths of prayer. And most often, you know, the best preachers are the ones who are preaching to themselves, you know, that, you know, what they've heard in prayer and in their in their reading of the scriptures. And the same should be, I think, in entering into the confessional, that, you know, there are prayers that the priest is to say before entering the confessional and leaving the confessional, that, you know, that it doesn't become simply, they don't become functionaries. And again, that they enter into the confessional not acting in accord with their own reason and judgment, but they act in persona Christi, and that they would never lose sight of that, that that they are to be engaging the person with the same love and gentleness of Christ, even if there is the gravest of sin. And, you know, what always strikes me is Christ's choosing of the apostles and some of the ones that he chose. And Matthew in particular stands out, you know, because we've talked about tax collectors and how they lived and made their money and how they were hated by all their fellow Jews, and how he simply walks into his office and tells him, "You follow me," and he leaves everything and follows him. Same thing with, you know, Peter and Andrew and James and John, that this encounter with love incarnate allows them to just drop everything and to follow after him. It's like in that moment they found the pearl of great price and they were willing to let go of everything in order to possess it. And they leave everything else behind. And, you know, this is the important thing that people would encounter at Mass from the pulpit and in the confessional, that they are drawn into this mystery of the incarnation, you know, the God who is among us and comes among us. And anything that becomes an impediment to the expression of that is problematic. And this is why there's a great need to pray for priests. You know, I think it is a terrible responsibility to get up and to proclaim the gospel, let alone to preach it, because it really demands that one looks hard at how one is living one's life, whether or not you're seeking to embrace what it is that you're preaching. And, you know, we have so many examples in the scriptures of the, you know, professional religious scribes and the Pharisees, those who were well-educated in the law, who knew it so well inside and out, and yet where there was this lack of charity towards their fellow man. The hoi polloi were seen as corrupt, you know, that they weren't living the law and the minute prescriptions that were seen as necessary to fulfilling it. They lost sight of love. Or, you know, where Jesus says, you know, declaring something Corban, you know, that you relieve yourself of the demands of charity, even to your mother and father. You know, you declare something dedicated to God, in order that it cannot be something that's given away. And so, you know, they were using something that they were, you know, saying was coming from the law in order to serve themselves and neglect the poor and the needy, even their own parents. So, you know, I'm sorry that, you know, I know that doesn't do justice to your experience, you know, but I think that should never be the experience of one in the confessional, especially one coming in to the church. You know, I think there should be the greatest amount of encouragement there. So we're a little over time. Again, I apologize, folks. And we went a little far afield today, but I think I was pretty comfortable in doing so. I mean, I don't, when there are these kinds of comments and questions, I'm always glad to go there. Okay. So we'll finish up this letter next time. Famous last words. And why don't we close as always with our Father. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God.